Good morning. This is Laura reading from the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, May 19th, 2025. The first article from the front page. The title is Pope Leo Vows to Work for Unity So Catholic Church Becomes a Symbol of Peace in the World. This is by Nicole Winfield from the Associated Press. Pope Leo XIV, history's first American pope, vowed on Sunday to work for unity so that the Catholic Church becomes a symbol of peace in the world, offering a message of communion during an inaugural mass at St. Peter's Square before an estimated 200,000 pilgrims, presidents, patriarchs, and princes. Pope Leo officially opened his pontificate by taking his first Popemobile tour through the piazza, a rite of passage that has become synonymous with the papacy's global reach and mediatic draw. The 69-year-old Augustinian missionary smiled and waved from the back of the truck to people waving U.S., Peruvian, and other national flags and stopped to bless some babies in the crowd. During the Mass, Leo appeared to choke up when the two potent symbols of the papacy were placed on him, the lamb's wool stole over his shoulders, and the fisherman's ring on his finger, as if the weight of responsibility of leading the 1.4 billion strong church had just sunk in. He turned his hand to look at the ring and then clasped his hands in front of him in prayer. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance, one of the last foreign officials to see Pope Francis before he passed away, led the U.S. delegation honoring the Chicago-born Leo. Vance paid his respects at the Argentine Pope's tomb after arriving in Rome late Saturday. In his homily, Leo said he wanted to be a servant to the faithful through the two dimensions of the papacy, love and unity, so that the Church could be a force for peace in the world. I would like that our first great desire be for a united Church, a sign of unity and communion, which becomes a leaven for a reconciled world, he said. In this our time, we still see too much discord, too many wounds caused by hatred, violence and prejudice, the fear of difference, and an economic paradigm that exploits the earth's resources and marginalizes the poorest. His call for unity was significant, given the polarization in the Catholic Church in the United States and beyond. Francis's radical 12-year pontificate, which emphasized care for the poor and marginalized and disdain for the capitalist economic system, often alienated conservatives who begged for a new pope who could pacify divisions. Leo's May 8th election, after a remarkable, quick 24-hour conclave, appears to have pleased conservative Catholics who seem to appreciate his more disciplined, traditional style and Augustinian background, emphasizing core truths of the Catholic doctrine. Leo drove that message home by wearing the formal red cape of the papacy, or Mozzetta, to receive Vance and official government delegations after the Mass. Francis eschewed many of the formalities of the papacy as part of his simple style, but Leo's return to the traditional garb pleased conservatives and traditionalists who cheered when he came out on the loggia wearing the red cape on May 8th. Leo did break with protocol, though, when he gave his older brother, Louis Prevost, a self-described political MAGA-type bear hug in the Basilica when he and his wife came up to greet the Pope. Let us build a church founded on God's love, a sign of unity, a missionary church that opens its arms to the world, proclaims the word, allows itself to be made restless by history, and become a leaven of harmony for humanity, Leo said, referencing some of the themes of Francis's pontificate as well. Strict diplomatic protocol dictated the seating arrangements at the inaugural Mass, with both the United States and Peru getting front-row seats thanks to Leo's dual citizenship. Vance, a Catholic convert who tangled with Francis over the Trump administration's mass migrant deportation plans, was joined by U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who arrived in Rome ahead of time to try to advance Russia-Ukraine peace talks. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte was one of around a dozen heads of state who attended, as well as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Russia had planned to send its culture minister, but was represented by its ambassador, reports said. Diplomatic protocol also dictated the dress code. While most wear black, the handful of Catholic queens and princesses, Leticia of Spain and Charlene of Monaco among them, wore white, and a special privilege allowed them. 36 of the world's other Christian churches sent their own delegations. The Jewish community had a 13-member delegation, half of them rabbis. Other representatives headed Buddhist, Muslim, Zoroastrian, Hindu, Sikh, and Jain delegations. Security was tight, as it was for Francis's funeral on April 26th, which drew an estimated 250,000 people. The Vatican said 200,000 were on hand Sunday in the piazza, and surrounding streets, parks, and piazzas where giant television screens and portable toilets were set up. At the end of the Mass, Leo expressed hope for negotiations to bring a just and lasting peace in Ukraine and offered prayers for the people of Gaza, children, families, and elderly who are reduced to starvation, he said. Leo made no mention of hostages taken by Hamas from southern Israel on October 7, 2023, as Francis usually did when praying for Gaza. Zelensky later had a formal audience with Leo at the Vatican and then met with Vance and Rubio at the U.S. residence in Rome. In a post on X, Zelensky said he stressed the need for a full and unconditional ceasefire as soon as possible and for diplomatic pressure on Russia until they are eager to stop the war. Susan Hansen, a professor who was born in Chicago and just arrived in Rome to teach, said she thought Leo's homily about unity would resonate in the United States and beyond. I think he will inspire, she said after Mass. What I particularly loved was the phrasing, unity within the doctrine of faith, and then in love. U.S. seminarian Ethan Menning, age 21, from Omaha, Nebraska, wrapped himself in an American flag purchased at a truck stop in Iowa to celebrate. Rome always felt like a home for Catholic, but now coming here and seeing one of our own on the throne of Peter, it almost makes Jesus himself more accessible, he said. Also on the front page of the Decatur Herald and Review, agriculture, weathering the trade war. This by the Associated Press, Kristen Hall and Steve Karnowski. Farmers say tariffs just one of many worries, waiting to see how things go. Waverly, Minnesota. Minnesota farmer Dan Glessing isn't ready to get too upset over President Donald Trump's trade wars. Farm country voted heavily for Trump last November. Now Glessing and many other farmers are taking a wait-and-see attitude toward the Republican president's disputes with China and other international markets. China normally would buy about one row out of every four of the Minnesota soybean crop and took in nearly $13 billion worth of soybeans from the United States as a whole last year. More than half of U.S. soybeans are exported internationally, with roughly half of those going to China, so it's a critical market. Trump last month raised U.S. tariffs on products from China to 145%, and China retaliated with a 125% raise. But the recent announcement of a 90-day truce between the two countries backed up the reluctance of many farmers to hit the panic button. More good news came in an updated forecast from the U.S. Department of Agriculture on Monday that projected higher corn exports and only slightly lower corn prices. The report also predicted somewhat lower soybean exports but higher domestic consumption, resulting in higher prices. Soybean futures surged. After he finished planting his soybean crop on Monday, Glessing said he was excited by the news and hopes to see more progress, but he said he wasn't really surprised. On a bright, sunny day last week, he began planting soybeans. Glessing said tariffs were only one of the things he was worried about, and not necessarily the biggest. Farming, after all, is an enterprise built on loose soil, the whims of weather, and other uncontrollable factors. Am I concerned about tariffs? Yeah, I mean, there's uncertainty that comes with that, Glessing said. Is that the number one driving factor in these poor commodity prices the last 2 years? No. Perhaps more skeptical than Glessing is Matt Griggs, one of many soybean farmers in Tennessee, paying close attention to the trade war. On Monday, he said the ripple effect on farmers might still be coming. We're only on a 90-day pause, Griggs said. Who knows what is coming after that? Even something that might seem like good news, ideal planting conditions across much of the Midwest, has its downsides. The potential for bigger crops sent prices downward, Glessing noted. High interest rates, seed and fertilizer costs pose additional challenges. There's so many factors besides just tariffs and my market price, Glessing said. But Glessing said he was encouraged by that morning's news of a trade deal with the United Kingdom and said he hopes the current uncertainty in talks with China and other countries ultimately leads to better trade deals going forward. Glessing finished planting his corn the day before on the other half of a field that he rents from his father's cousin, split between 45 acres of corn and 45 acres of beans. It's at the farm where his grandfather grew up, and it's part of the approximately 700 acres he plants on average. He locked in those planting decisions months earlier as he made deals for seeds, fertilizer, and other supplies. Back on his home farm, closer to Waverly, where his late grandfather's house, made of local brick, still stands, and a lot of house sparrow songs filled the air, Glessing was pleased to spot the first sign of corn he had planted there about 10 days earlier, poking above the soil. Waverly is about an hour west of Minneapolis. Its most famous resident was Democrat, former Vice President Hubert Humphrey. It's in the congressional district represented by Republican House Majority Whip Tom Emmer. Glessing's post as president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau puts him in close touch with other influential politicians, too. He and his wife, Sina, were Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar's guests at the Capitol for Trump's inauguration in January. Glessing declined to say who he voted for. The Glessings have 4 kids, milk about 75 dairy cows, and grow corn, soybeans, and alfalfa on a combination of parcels they own or rent. He uses the alfalfa and corn primarily to feed his cows. He sells his soybeans to a processing plant in Mankato, where some of them become soybean meal he adds to his animal feed. The milk from his cows go to a co-op cheese plant in Litchfield that sells internationally. Because Glessing has local buyers locked in and doesn't directly export his crops, he's partially cushioned from the volatility of world markets. But he's quick to point out that everything in the agricultural economy is interconnected. On his farm near Humboldt, Tennessee, roughly between Memphis and Nashville, Griggs weathered the 2018 trade war during Trump's first term and says he feels more prepared this time around. Back in 2018, prices were about the same as they are now, and due to the trade war with China, prices dropped about 15%, he said. They dropped significantly lower, and they dropped in a hurry, and due to that, we lost a lot of demand from China. Griggs said exports to China never fully rebound, but he doesn't think the impact of the current dispute will be nearly as drastic. Griggs, who raises about 1,600 acres of cotton, corn, and soybeans, and wheat, said tariffs were just one consideration as he planned out this year's crops. Growing a variety of crops helps him minimize the risk that comes with weather, volatile prices, and now the prospect of a trade war. Griggs says he's going to be watching for opportunities to sell when market volatility causes upticks in prices. The main thing I learned in 2018 was that if you do have a price period where prices have risen some, go ahead and take advantage of it instead of waiting for it to go higher, Griggs said. Because when it comes to the tariffs and everything, the markets can be very unpredictable. So my lesson learned was, don't hold out for a home run, be satisfied with a double. Now moving on to the state and nation page, page number 3, Republicans Trump coordinate tax bill. This article by the Associated Press, Matt Brown and Leah Asgharnam. From Washington, days before Republicans unveiled their sweeping tax cut plan, the chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee had one last person to consult. He went to the White House, where he and President Donald Trump went over the legislation line by line. He was very happy with what we were delivering, said Representative Jason Smith, a Republican from Missouri. The legislation realizes that many of Trump's campaign promises, temporarily ending taxes on overtime and tips for many workers, creating a new $10,000 tax breaks on auto loan interest for American-made cars, and even creating a new tax-free MAGA account, a nod to his Make America Great movement. But in this case, it means money accounts for growth and advancement. This would contribute $1,000 to children born in his second term. The Trump-inspired contours of the legislative package, months if not years in the making, reflect not only the president's considerable influence over the Republican Party, but also the hard political realities in the House, where Republicans have only the barest of majorities and often find it difficult to find consensus without Trump's involvement. Speaker Mike Johnson effectively owes his job to Trump and has kept in constant contact with him during the negotiations, including during his overseas trip this past week. He's excited about our forward progress, Johnson said. You know, I keep him apprised of the developments, and he's had a busy time over there in the Middle East, and it's been good. He's in good spirits, and we're all in good spirits. The Republican bill runs 1,116 pages and includes more than $5 trillion in tax cuts, costs partially offset by spending cuts elsewhere and other changes in the tax code. The legislation would make permanent the tax cuts from Trump's first term while reducing funding for programs involving food assistance, college financing, and environmental protection. Divisions emerged among Republicans, particularly between fiscal hawks most concerned about federal deficits and others more focused on the impact of cuts back home. That's where Trump usually plays the closer, who turns no votes to yes. President Trump has gone out of his way to ask us, are there any members you want me to call? Anybody that you want me to talk to? And he calls them right then, said House Majority Leader Steve Scalise. He's been incredibly hands-on and incredibly helpful getting the bill to where it is. Trump's involvement seems certain to grow as Johnson labors to get the tax package through the House by a self-imposed Memorial Day deadline. Conservatives slowed the process Friday, refusing to advance the tax package out of the House Budget Committee until it includes faster implementation of Medicaid changes and a more wholesale repeal of Biden-era green energy credits. They vowed to hold firm until their demands are met. Trump took notice, applying pressure even before the gavel went down on the failed committee vote. We don't need grandstanders in the Republican Party, Trump wrote on social media. Stop talking and get it done. Negotiations were expected to stretch through the weekend, with the Budget Committee reconvening late Sunday night in hopes of a breakthrough. Representative Mike Rogers, Republican, Alabama, chairman of the House Armed Service Committee, predicted the tax package will get over the finish line once Trump starts making calls to skeptical lawmakers. The close coordination with Republican leaders stands in stark contrast to Trump's first term, when the party first enacted a slew of personal and corporate tax breaks. Republicans quickly cobbled together that tax package in late 2017 after a disastrous attempt at fulfilling their central campaign promise, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare. This time, White House aides have been in regular contact with GOP lawmakers as the tax bill progresses through drafts and markups, highlighting programs they aim to overhaul and provisions they'd like to add or cut. The president is much more engaged in directing what happens than the first time because he and the leadership of Congress in 2017 were not seeing eye to eye, Scalise said. He didn't necessarily want health care to be the first thing that was done, and yet it was. This time around, we talked a lot before he was sworn in to make sure we were all on the same page. Trump first began to set the course of the GOP's current legislative strategy back in January, when he posted to social media that Republicans should pass one powerful bill that would tackle all of the party's priorities instead of splitting the agenda into two packages. Senate Republicans argued for a different approach. They urged quick passage of a bill to provide billions for the Pentagon and Trump's immigration clampdown, saying a second tax package could wait until later. Here's another article from the Associated Press written by Josh Boak. The title, Biden Has Aggressive Form of Prostate Cancer. From Washington, former President Joe Biden was diagnosed with prostate cancer in his office said Sunday. Biden was seen by doctors last week after urinary symptoms and a prostate nodule were found. He was diagnosed with prostate cancer on Friday, with the cancer cells having spread to the bone. While this represents a more aggressive form of the disease, the cancer appears to be hormone sensitive, which allows for effective management, his office said. The president and his family are reviewing treatment options with his physicians. Prostate cancers are given a score called a Gleason score that measures on a scale of 1 to 10 how the cancerous cells look compared with normal cells. Biden's office said his score was 9, suggesting his cancer is among the most aggressive. When prostate cancer spreads to other parts of the body, it often spreads to the bones. Metastasized cancer is much harder to treat than localized cancer because it can be hard for drugs to reach all the tumors and completely root out the disease. However, when prostate cancer needs hormones to grow, as in Biden's case, they can be susceptible to treatment that deprives the tumors of hormones. The health of Biden, aged 82, was a dominant concern among voters during his time as president. After a calamitous debate performance in June while seeking re-election, Biden abandoned his bid for a second term. Then Vice President Kamala Harris became the nominee and lost to Republican Donald Trump, who returned to the White House after a 4-year hiatus. But in recent days, Biden rejected concerns about his age despite reporting in the new book, Original Sin, by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson, that aides had shielded the public from the extent of his decline while serving as president. In February 2023, Biden had a skin lesion removed from his chest that was a basal cell carcinoma, a common form of skin cancer. And in November 2021, he had a polyp removed from his colon that was a benign but potentially precancerous lesion. In 2022, Biden made a cancer moonshot, one of his administration's priorities, with the goal of halving the cancer rate, death rate over the next 25 years. The initiative was a continuation of his work as vice president to address a disease that killed his older son, Beau, who died from brain cancer in 2015. His father, when announcing the goal to halve the cancer death rate, said this could be an American moment to prove to ourselves and, quite frankly, the world, that we can do really big things. Here's an article from the State page, title, Three Police Officers Hit by Gunfire in Metro East. This is from Fairview Heights, written by Allison Petty at lee.net. Three officers from a Metro East Police Department were shot while responding to a call for service, the department's chief said on Sunday. Fairview Heights Police Chief Steve Johnson said officers were dispatched at 9:44 p.m. in response to a report of suspicious individual prowling around a residence in a suburban St. Clair County community. Upon making contact with the person, arriving officers found it was a possible domestic situation, Johnson said. He said the suspect, about whom no identifying details were shared, opened fire on the officers, three of whom were struck by gunfire. One officer underwent emergency surgery after being shot in the face and was in critical but stable condition Sunday, the chief said. A second officer was undergoing treatment for a gunshot wound to the arm that also led to a broken bone, Johnson said. A third officer was apparently shot in the back, but a bulletproof vest stopped the bullet. This officer was treated and released, according to the chief. Two others were treated and released for injuries they sustained while fighting with the suspect. The suspect is in custody, Johnson said, and the gun was recovered. Illinois State Police are leading the investigation because of the department's direct involvement. If it is your way, we ask for prayers for these officers, Johnson said, in a statement posted on social media. They went on a call for service to help people and keep people safe. They ended up being shot and fighting for their lives by just doing their job. From the Associated Press, an article by Dylan Lovin, residents in the Midwest and the South dig out from major storms, 27 people killed. Residents in Kentucky and Missouri sifted through damage in tornado-stricken neighborhoods and cleared debris Sunday after severe storms swept through parts of the Midwest and South and killed more than two dozen people. Kentucky was hardest hit as a devastating tornado damaged hundreds of homes, tossed vehicles, and left many homeless. At least 18 people were killed, most of them in southeastern Laurel County. 10 more people were critically injured, with state leaders saying the death toll could still rise. We are hard at work this morning addressing this tragic damage and deaths caused by severe weather, said Governor Andy Beshear on X on Sunday morning. We are securing emergency housing for options, looking into sites for intermediate housing. The latest Kentucky storms were part of the weather system Friday that killed seven in Missouri and two in Northern Virginia, authorities said. The system also spawned tornadoes in Wisconsin, brought punishing heat to Texas, and temporarily enveloped parts of Illinois, including Chicago, in a pall of dust on an otherwise sunny day. In St. Louis, Mayor Kara Spencer said five people died and 38 were injured. More than 5,000 homes were affected. The devastation is truly heartbreaking, she said at a news conference on Saturday. A tornado struck in Scott County, about 130 miles south of St. Louis, killing two people, injuring several others, and destroying multiple homes, Sheriff Derek Wheatley wrote on social media. The storms hit after the Trump administration massively cut staffing of National Weather Service officers, with outside experts worrying about how it would affect warnings in disasters such as tornadoes. The office in Jackson, Kentucky, which is responsible for the area around London, Kentucky, had a March 2025 vacancy rate of 25%. The St. Louis office was down 16%, according to calculations by Weather Service employees obtained by the Associated Press. The Louisville office was also without a permanent boss, the meteorologist in charge, as of March, according to staffing data. Experts say any vacancy rate above 20% is a critical problem.